Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. Kant's second formulation of the categorical imperative is always easier to understand when we start applying it to a number of different examples. And Kant provides a number of these. I actually want to consider some examples that Kant doesn't bring up, but which I've used in classes, students have come up with at times, and which I think could be very helpful for helping you wrap your head around how you would actually apply this moral principle, the categorical imperative. And this one is easier, I think, for the average student to apply and to understand than the first formulation. The first formulation requires you to do a bit of imagining of what would the world be like if everybody did this, and would there be any logical contradictions, and that gets a little bit sticky. With this, you can keep coming back to the touchstone of, are you treating a person as if they have dignity, as if they have a capacity to choose for themselves? Are you respecting them? Or are you treating them as what Kant calls a means, as something to be used, as something which has value only insofar as it satisfies one of your own ends or somebody else's ends? That's kind of a touchstone that you can use. But let's take a look at certain examples. So before we do that, let's review. Act in such a way that you always treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of another, never simply as a means, but always as the same at the same time as an end. So four important concepts there in two pairs. You're supposed to treat humanity in your own person or in the person of another. So you can't just get off the hook by saying, I'm not hurting anybody else, I'm not affecting anybody else, so therefore whatever I do is A-okay. Kant says that's not the case. Because you have to be concerned with duties that you actually have towards yourself and how you're treating humanity in yourself. The other main set of concepts are the means and end. A means is something that you choose or produce or pursue or value because it leads to something else that you actually want more, the end. And Kant says that we have merely subjective ends, which, you know, largely stem from our desires and inclinations. You know, they could be shared with other people, but they're not universal. They're not things that everybody can say, yes, that's something that one ought to pursue, one ought to make an end. And then we have objective ends, which apply for any rational being. Now, notice any rational being, and I would actually add any rational being who's actually acting in a rational way and not sort of subverting the rationality that they have. So all that said, now let's think about some examples that Kant himself doesn't cover. So I think one of the best ways to think about this is by contrast to another moral theory, which we call utilitarianism. One of the things that utilitarianism would say is okay is to distribute harms or risks or losses or even frustrations to a small group of people or even just to one person if that's for the benefit of the larger community. Would that be permissible for somebody like Kant? Would this categorical imperative say that that could be morally justified? And the answer is no. Why? Well, unless you're actually bringing them into this very process and making them, you know, aware of everything that could happen and allowing them to say yes or no to it, so it could be a voluntary choice of their own, which usually isn't the case for these sorts of things, you would be treating that person as a mere means. Let's take a fairly extreme example. Let's say, for the sake of entertainment, we institute death matches between convicted prisoners. Convicted murderers, let's say. Kant would say you can't do that sort of thing. You can do it, but it would be immoral to do it. Because you would be treating those people as means for an end of entertainment of other people. And it wouldn't matter how many other people you entertain. It wouldn't matter whether it's 100 or, you know, 100,000 or 100 million, it would still be wrong to do it. And the same thing would go if you think about environmental costs and benefits. Or, you know, if you apply this to economic dislocations, you know, when you put a lot of people at risk or deprive them of their livelihood or their dignity because it benefits the economy, I think from a Kantian perspective, that would actually be something wrong. It would actually be something immoral, because you would be treating those people, once again, as mere means to the end of greater economic efficiency, larger profit, or something like that. Even if you could get them to sign off on it, I think that he would say, in that case, they would be treating themselves as a mere means to some sort of end. Unless they could actually recognize that this is the thing that needs to be done morally, it's the only good choice that could be made, they would be treating themselves as a mere means to an end. And so would the other people who would be using them. If, for example, they were to take financial inducements, you know, if we were to start a lottery and say, cancer will be distributed so that, you know, only one person gets cancer, and when they do it, they'll get this payoff that'll, you know, provide them with 5 years of great life before they die of cancer, and nobody else will ever get cancer again. Kant would say something like that would not be a good thing to do. The person would be, in effect, trading being used as a means for the benefit of other people for financial gain, which would be a subjective end of theirs, but really wouldn't be an objective end. Well, let's go on now. What about some other cases? Kant says, not that it's generally wrong to lie to people, but that it's always wrong to lie to people. He's very stringent when it comes to that. Well, why? Think about what's going on when you actually lie to a person. Are you depriving them of anything? Well, when do you lie to somebody? Let's take some actual cases. Imagine you're a salesperson and you have an inferior product and you need to move that product, because if you don't, then you're not going to make any money, or perhaps even you'll lose your job. You'll be threatened with something or another. So you lie to the person and you tell them that this product that you're selling is actually as good as or even better than the competitor's products. You're treating that person then as a means to whatever it is that you're trying to attain by selling that product, whether it's, you know, security, whether it's financial gain, whether it's the things that you get to buy with the money, whether it's, you know, a sense of self-esteem on your part. You would still be treating that person as a mere means to an end. You'd be depriving them of a good, the good of truth. You'd also be depriving them of the capacity to make an informed choice. You would be interfering with their capacity to set ends for themselves. You would not be treating them as a genuinely free, rational being. You would not be respecting humanity in them. What about some other examples? What if you could lie to one person and that would help a lot of other people? Well, that would be similar to the case of distributing harms in such a way that only a few people got harms and the rest of the people were benefited or at least evaded the harms. Again, you would be using the person to whom you're lying, you would be using them as a means to, say, the happiness or the welfare or the further development, pick whatever you like, of those other people. Could we imagine situations like that? I think we can. Think about how we might conceal things when we're asked about them from a family member who tends to fly off the handle and make family meetings unpleasant as a result. Now, I'm not myself a Kantian. I would actually say in that case, yeah, lie to them and keep the peace. Because by behaving like a fool in those cases, they have in some way deprived themselves of an expectation of being told the truth. But Kant would say, no, you actually, if you're asked, you know, point blank, is so-and-so doing this, and that's some scandalous thing that will get this person on a tirade, Kant would actually say, you actually do have to tell the truth in that case, even though it's going to lead to worse consequences for everybody else. Because otherwise, again, you're treating that person who you're lying to as a mere means to the happiness or or harmony within the group of the other people. Let's take another case, another fairly cut and dry case. Think about stealing. Now, why do people steal? Let's take sort of typical cases. As a matter of fact, I'll actually use one from my own childhood. I remember shoplifting when I was a kid, and it was, you know, it was fairly small stuff. It was candy, and we were at the Kickapoo store, and we almost got caught because we were really stupid in the way we were doing it. And the clerk was, you know, clearly eyeing us up, and we were scared we were going to get caught by the cops. Anyway, why did we do it? Well, I think the other kids did it basically just because they liked breaking the rules and because they'd gotten away with it before. And because they like candy. And I shared that liking with them. I liked candy too. And I didn't like paying for candy because back then, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. Candy was expensive. We actually had to walk about a mile and a half through the meadows to get to this store too, by the way, because we lived way out in the country. So the other reason that I had was I wanted to, these were older boys and they were, you know, kind of troublemakers. And I was friends with them and I wanted to fit in. So the question is, who's being used in this? And this is a case where there's multiple uses going on. So to begin with, I'm using the clerk or perhaps the store itself, which is a company of people. I'm using them as a mere means to these aims that I have of getting candy on the cheap or for free and impressing my friends and fitting in, you know, whatever psychological needs that I have. I'm treating those people as lower, as of less value than my friends who I want to fit in with, and myself, and my own desires. Now, am I treating myself badly as a result as well? And this is something that could apply to some of these other cases too. Am I treating the humanity in myself in a way that makes it into a mere means to certain ends? I think yes. If my life is fundamentally centered around candy and the consumption of candy, that's a flawed life from a Kantian perspective. Even for a child, what I ought to be doing is developing, and I ought to be gaining. I ought to be progressing as a moral being, and instead I'm actually setting myself behind by doing something that's establishing a bad habit, doing something that brings culpability upon myself, particularly, you know, given the fact that I'm doing this with other people, that reinforces it. So I am, in fact, treating humanity within myself as a mere means to something, you know, getting candy or the respect of other people. It's kind of ironic because if they really respected me, according to Kant, what they would respect is my capacity to do the right thing. They wouldn't be coercing me or seducing me into doing the wrong thing. And likewise, for me, I wouldn't be doing that with them as well. Now, what about other cases of stealing? This is where it starts to get kind of interesting and kind of sticky. Let's take the classic case of the father who steals bread because he has no livelihood. His livelihood has been eliminated and he has to feed his children. Is his act of stealing wrong? He is certainly breaking the law. He's doing something that is to the benefit of his children. As a matter of fact, somebody like Thomas Aquinas, in considering this, says, you know, that's probably not even properly described as stealing. It's better described as doing what you have to do to feed people who you're responsible for. Kant does not seem to go along with this sort of thing. Now, does he do this because I would be treating humanity in the baker as a mere means to an end? I suppose so. This is one of those cases where, again, I would diverge from Kant. So would Thomas Aquinas, presumably so would Aristotle, and so would the utilitarians. And I would be inclined to say, well, what about the humanity in my children? If I don't actually go and get that bread, and I'm the only person who can do it, and the only way in which I can do it, the only way in which I can actually keep them alive is by doing this. Am I not treating them as something like a means to my own moral rectitude? This is a puzzling case. And I am not entirely aligned with Kant on this sort of thing. Let's shift now to something else, which might be less controversial. Relationships. Think about what goes on in relationships. Do people use each other? Yeah, we know that they do because, I mean, Aristotle, in discussing the different kinds of friendship, tells us, hey, some friendships are in terms of the person themselves and their value and their dignity, and some are just in terms of use. And we do experience a lot of relationships in which we do see people use each other, or we feel used, or we allow ourselves to be used. Kant would say in that case, what we're doing is actually wrong. So if two people marry, and let's take the sort of typical trophy bride scenario. The trophy bride is marrying, and they'll say, well, it's because I love this guy. But you look at him, and you're like, oh, no. This guy is thoroughly repulsive, physically and morally, and as a person. There's no way that you're actually in love with him. You know, you could be in love with this guy over here, but not this one. He just happens to be filthy rich. So she's using him for money. She's getting married to him. She's making an agreement with him to what? To allow access to her sexually, to be sort of arm candy. And this could work the other way around, too. It could be, you know, a very rich but kind of repugnant woman and some boy toy, too, who's going along for money. Both people are using each other in that case. And some people would look at that and say, nothing wrong with it. So long as they're okay with the terms of the contract, perfectly fine for them. They're exercising their autonomy. Kant would say, well, that's not really autonomy in the right sense. That's following purely subjective ends, deciding for yourself money is the center of the universe, but that's not really being a rational being, and that's not respecting all the other things in yourself besides whatever it is that you're using to make some money. There's more to you, Kant would say, to a person in these cases. There's more to you than just a moneymaker. You are worth more than that. You're worth more than any amount of dollars or bonds or stocks or property or pick whatever you like, opportunities. Likewise, Kant would say to the person who's marrying the other person and getting them into the relationship, by virtue of the fact that they have all this money, just so they can sleep with them, who perhaps even just acquired all that money so they can sleep with people. He would say they are using the other person, clearly, and they're allowing themselves to be used too. If you get into a relationship with another person, and that other person is just using you for money, they're doing something wrong to you, but you're allowing it to be done to you. By maintaining that relationship, by choosing that, by doing it over and over and over again, you're actually treating yourself as a means to whatever it is that you're getting out of that situation. It could be physical pleasure, it could be prestige, it could be self-satisfaction, it could be a variety of things. But whatever it is, it's not going to be some sort of objective end that everybody could look at and say, that's the right thing to do, that is something that's really worth it. Because people clearly look at it and they say, what is wrong here? So what about other relationships? Relationships are very hard, aren't they? Are there cases where we do use each other in relationships? I think so. Here's where we get to a very important point. Remember I said earlier, you can treat a person as a means if you're also genuinely treating them as an end at the same time. I think that many relationships, and in particular many marriages, are cases in which somebody is being used as a means some of the time, but because they're also being furthered, they're being treated as an end, they're being allowed to develop, to choose, to engage in decision-making together. At least that's the way a good marriage is. That's the way a true partnership works. When you have that, then you can have the development of genuine intimacy. Kant doesn't talk much about that, but I think that you could actually fit that into this framework. Now, what about something that would threaten that? Cheating, adultery, breaking one's commitments to another person to remain faithful. Let's say I'm married to somebody, and I find somebody else that I think is attractive, and I go and sleep with her. Now, I'm probably just treating that person as a means towards sexual satisfaction, right? Because I'm already in a marriage. I'm not going to marry that person. I'm just, you know, engaging in sex. But I'm also treating that person who I'm married to in a way that is below the way that they ought to be treated. I'm treating them as a means. I'm not treating them as an end, because how do I know that? Well, you know, if I actually treated them as an end, one of the things that they want is me not to go and screw somebody else, right? So if I were to actually respect the desires, the capacity to set goals, the capacity to say this matters to me of the other person with whom I'm in a committed relationship, you know, it's committed, right? I would have to stay faithful to them. Would I also be treating myself as a means to an end by breaking that commitment? I think so. I'd be treating myself as a moral being, and that's humanity, as a mere means to getting some sexual gratification. So that would not be a moral act. Let's think about another one, actually, too, where a person is being treated both as a means and as an end. This is what I use in my classes all the time when I discuss this material. Education itself. When I walk in the classroom, I'm there because I'm getting paid. And I probably would not be there for at least most of the classes that I teach. I might volunteer to teach some, but I probably wouldn't be there for most of them unless I was getting paid. So, I mean, those students are, in a certain respect, a means to an end. As a matter of fact, when I teach certain classes, I might be paid per student. It might matter the headcount. So each person is worth this amount of money to me. Now, if I were only to focus on that, I would be treating them as just a means to an end, wouldn't I? If I were just to engage in a transaction where I say, I'm going to give you this intellectual content and you're going to give me some money back, and that's all there is to it, then I would be violating. There are other ways in which I could do that as an educator as well. If I'm only getting up in front of these students so I can have power over them, for example. I've known some pedagogues like that. If I'm doing it just so I can be the, as they say, the sage on the stage, the big player up in front of everybody else, telling them how it is and what they ought to think, essentially demanding that they be my audience. Again, I would be treating them as a means to something else, a different type of subjective end that I have, in this case, power or authority or gratification rather than merely money. What ought I be doing as an educator? How would I be able to treat them as an end, as somebody who actually gets to make decisions, who has value, who has human dignity, who can develop? Well, I better actually be teaching them. Some learning had better be taking place. And I had better, if I'm a real educator, be devoting quite a bit of thought to how my students do in fact learn and what this student over here needs and what this student over here needs. This would actually go down to the level of curriculum design. I would go so far as to say this. If today I am teaching college classes and the only assignments that I have over the course of the semester are two or three papers over the course of the semester, and I'm not giving feedback on those papers in a draft process or something like that, I'm violating Kant's categorical imperative, I would say. Because all I'm doing then is getting to study what I want to study and using my students as basically a way to keep myself employed. I'm not actually teaching them the way that I could be, the way that I ought to be. If I'm teaching my students in a 16-week class, there had better be weekly assignments at the very least, and I'd better get those graded and get them feedback so that these students can actually get themselves, if they go off course, they can get themselves back on course so learning can really take place. Then I would actually be treating them as an end. This is kind of interesting because, you know, what it points out is that maybe, you know, what it counts to treat somebody as an end gets more stringent as we learn more about what's required. That leads us to another good example. What about parenting? Think about parents. You look at them and you can tell that they're just using their children as sort of little images of themselves. They are not concerned with what's really good for the child, even though they've managed to convince themselves that whatever it is that they're doing is really good for the child. They want the child to go and be in this club or play this sport or do this thing or get this grade point level because that's what would look good on them. It would reflect good on them, and then they would feel like they're a good parent. Ironically, by doing that, they're actually not a good parent. Certainly not in any sort of conscience sense. They're actually violating the categorical imperative. They are treating their children as mere means to an end. What is required for a parent, a real parent, has to care about their children in such a way that they tend to promote the development of their children as human beings. That's to treat them as an end. Doesn't mean giving in to them on everything. Doesn't mean being friends with your kids. It doesn't mean saying, whatever you choose, little junior, is A-okay. Because, you know, some of the subjective ends that kids have are crazy stuff that's not good for them, right? I mean, that's part of the process of growing up, is trying to get away with some crazy stuff and then, you know, learning by experience that it's not a good idea, and hopefully by watching some other poor bastard's, you know, bad experience and not having to undergo it yourself. But somewhere along the line, if the parents are not treating the child as an end, and treating the child as an end, I think, is going to require more and more and more as the child gets older. There will be a lot more things when the child is young where the parent can be, you know, much more authoritative. This is difficult. This is not easy stuff to nail down, but this is really worth thinking about in terms of Kant's categorical imperative formulation too, because it has to do with this central conception of whether you are treating a person as a mere means, as just an object to satisfy your own or somebody else's desires, even if it does satisfy some of their own desires, or whether you're treating them as an equal, whether you're treating them as somebody who has equal dignity with you, even though they may not have the same power position, as having the same value as you. You know, a parent who punishes, if they really can say and really mean it, this is hurting me more than it's going to hurt you, I think in that case, the parent would not just be treating the child as a means, but be treating the child as an end. If the parent is punishing the kid and enjoying the punishment, and they're punishing the kid because they like doing that, they're treating that kid as a means. If the parent is punishing the kid so that the kid stays out of trouble, so that the parent doesn't look bad in the eyes of their peers, again, they're treating them as a means. They're not treating them as an end. And kids perceive this. Kids can see through this sort of thing. Because Kant is onto something really vital here. Let's think about one other example. Can you sell yourself in the sense of engaging in degrading behavior, humiliating behavior for the, you know, financial gain? Would that be allowable? Clearly not. Kant would say in that case you're treating humanity and yourself as a mere means to financial gain. If you were to do that for other reasons, to fit in, allowing other people to, say, line up and humiliate you, and you put up with it just because you want to fit in. First off, you're not really fitting in. But again, you would be treating humanity in yourself as a mere means, not as an end. And you'd be allowing other people to treat that humanity in yourself as a mere means as well. Could you do things like this in other respects? Prostitution. I think Kant would say prostitution would be an example of this, where you allow somebody to use you for financial gain. And again, that would be allowing somebody to use your humanity as a mere means, and thereby treating yourself as a mere means in the process. Even if you're making good money out of it, even if you choose your clients, I think Kant would say in this case, it would not be moral. That's probably a good place to leave off. We've covered a lot of examples. Hopefully by now, this somewhat abstract formulation has attained some consistency and some actual flesh for you. And now you have a much better understanding of how to apply Kant's categorical imperative, the second formulation.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.